would. Zechariah chapter number 11. Chapter number 11. When we began the study of Zechariah, we began by saying that Zechariah is a book of comfort and encouragement. It is a prophecy of hope and a promise that God would restore Israel to a greater glory than they had ever known before. The message was given to a discouraged remnant of people. They've been released from captivity. They've come back to Jerusalem, back to the homeland. But the joy of coming back has been tempered by the stark reality that they would never be what they had been before the captivity. The city was in complete ruins. The temple was in shambles. There are no walls, no defenses around the city. You can take my monitor down just a little bit. The people are poor, and there's little hope that they would ever be the mighty nation that they had been at one time. The problem is that's what God had promised. Not just a return from captivity, but that God would make of them a glorious kingdom and they would have a great king. So how do you reconcile their present conditions and the reality of their prospects with the promise that God made of them being a glorious nation? That's where Zechariah comes in. He comes in for just a couple of months. He preaches a message of hope, one that basically says God has not forgotten his people, nor has God forgotten his covenants. And so it is a book of comfort. It is a book of hope. I hope that you have seen that as we've made our way through the first 10 chapters. When you get to chapter 11, however, there is no comfort. There is no hope, and there is no encouragement. So far, we have read about a regathering and a restoration. That's the main message of Zechariah. We know that in the future there is a national salvation for Israel. There is a glorious kingdom when Jesus comes the second time. We also know that there was a time of national apostasy, that Israel rejected their Messiah the first time that he came. And that is what Zechariah chapter 11 is about. Zechariah has been forecasting way out 2,500 years into the future. But in chapter 11, he comes back a little bit and he talks about that first coming. In chapter 9 and in chapter 10, there's the promise of kingdom glories. But when Christ came the first time, there were no kingdom glories. In chapter 11, he tells you why that was postponed. Now, when I look at chapter number 11, it is a most difficult chapter. But I look at the chapter into two parts. There is an introduction, and then there are two parts. And what's going to happen in this chapter is Zechariah is actually going to act out the prophecy instead of preaching or speaking the prophecy. I believe there are two roles that he takes, and hopefully by the time I'm done, you will believe there are two roles that he takes as well. Look, if you would, at verse number 1. We're going to walk our way through the chapter as we normally do and see if we can make some sense of it. Zechariah chapter 11 and verse number 1. Open thy doors, O Lebanon, that the fire may devour thy cedars. How, fir tree? For the cedar is fallen, because the mighty are spoiled. How, O ye oaks of Bashan? For the forest of the vintage is come down. There is a voice of the howling of the shepherds, for their glory is spoiled. A voice of the roaring of young lions, for the pride of Jordan is spoiled. Now stop right there. This is difficult for me because it is Hebrew poetry. It is written in poetic language. Now, I never did do well with poetry. I never understood poetry. When I had to take American literature and English literature, it meant absolutely nothing to me. Because to me, poetry is trying to say something without actually saying it. I'm more of a just say what you mean kind of guy. Don't hide it in all of this. But that's what poetry is supposed to do. It's supposed to be, it's confusing by design. All right? So this is a judgment passage. And it's in poetic languages. There are three areas that are referenced. In verse number 1, there's Lebanon. A little cool in here. Lebanon. In verse 2, there is Bashan. In verse 3, there is Jordan.
Now, if you located those three areas on a map of Israel, you would see that it goes from north to south. So he's prophesying a judgment in poetic language, and the judgment is going to start north, and it's going to sweep south down through the land. Then you will notice that judgment is on trees. I'm trying to interpret poetry, all right? There are the trees of the cedars of Lebanon. There are fir trees in verse 2. There is the oaks of Bashan. And then you have the pride of Jordan in verse number 3. Now, I don't believe that these verses are describing a forest fire. I believe that the trees probably are being personalized and they stand in for people. Poetic language would do that. Poetic language would use something and poetically it represents something else. So trees would poetically represent the land. Lebanon was known for its mighty cedars. So instead of saying Lebanon, no, the poet has to say the cedars of Lebanon, all right? Bashan is closer to the east side of Israel. It's populated by mighty oaks. The Jordan Valley is overgrown by thick foliage. So what the writer does, he takes the most prominent feature of that area and he uses that feature to speak poetically of the entire area. Now, when the judgment comes, it seems that there is a sense in that they won't be able to stop it. When God brings this judgment, there is nothing that you can do about it. Look at verse number 1. Open thy doors, O Lebanon, that the fire may devour thy cedars. I believe the sense of it is that you might as well open your doors because it's coming, whether you like it or not. Just go ahead and accept it. Verse 2. How fir tree for the cedar is fallen. When you see the mighty cedars of Lebanon fall, start howling, because you're next. How, O ye oaks of Bashan, for the forest of the vintage is come down. When the mighty are fallen, hey Bashan, your oaks are next. It's coming. There's a progression here. When the most magnificent forest goes up in flames, then start howling, because you're next and you can't escape it. Verse number 3 mentions lions roaring, the roaring voice of the roaring of young lions, for the pride of Jordan is spoiled. And remember, poetry likes to make a play on words, and maybe there's a play on words because pride, a group of lions, I believe is called a pride. And a lot of commentators say that Jordan was inhabited by wild beasts and lions were beginning to make it their home. So when you think of Jordan, you don't think of a cedar tree, you don't think of an oak tree, you would think of lions. And so what these first three verses are saying, I believe is what it's saying, is that God's going to bring a judgment, devastation is going to start in the north, it's going to head all the way down south, it's going to sweep across the land. It's not a forest fire that kills trees, but it's poetic language that says, judgment is coming to these three areas, there's nothing that you can do to stop it. Judgment is on its way. Verse number 3 also mentions the howling of shepherds. There is a voice of the howling of the shepherds, for their glory is spoiled. Now, we're going to see shepherds in a minute in the chapter, all right? And some commentators say that the shepherds in verse 3 speaks of the false shepherds of Israel. I'm not too sure it would fit the context, but it would also fit the context if the shepherds in verse 3 are actual shepherds in the field. And they see the judgment is coming, and they see it firsthand, all this devastation that is coming. Now here's my question for you, all right? It's a prophecy about judgment, sweeping across the land, going to be devastating, nothing you can do to stop it. So here is the question. When did that judgment happen? Or has that judgment ever happened? From our time, Zechariah is about 2,500 years behind us. So if you take from Zechariah's time to the present, has there been any time in Israel's history since that point that this kind of judgment came against Israel? And I believe that it was. I believe that about 30 or 40 years after the crucifixion, after the time of Christ, the Roman Empire came to Israel and literally destroyed Jerusalem. AD 70, you may know the date. AD 70, Titus, the Roman general, came in and Israel ceased to be a nation in the land. It is said that over 1 million Jews were killed in the siege against Jerusalem. A few years after that, Hadrian came by and he swept through the land and destroyed 985 villages in the land of Israel. The Romans literally destroyed a civilization of people except for a very small remnant that escaped. It was so bad during the siege of Jerusalem that parents were eating their own children because of the starvation of the city. It is said that during the siege of Jerusalem that they threw 100,000 Jews over the walls to their death. Utterly vile, utter devastation. 40 years after they rejected their Messiah, the nation is so destroyed that it literally ceased to be a nation in the land and would not be a nation for the next 1,900 years. And I believe that these verses, verse 1 through 3, is describing that devastation. Zechariah is going to prophesy about it, the devastation that is coming to Israel. Now that brings us to verse number 4. And in verse number 4, Zechariah is going to prophesy to them why that judgment is coming. And there are two acts that he's going to play. The first one is in verse number 4 down to verse number 14. It is the rejection of Israel's true shepherd. Now, if you think this is a tough passage to listen to, you should try to preach it. This is a tough chapter. And you've got to give me some grace as I make my way through this. But one of the ways that prophets prophesied sometimes was by acting out their prophecy. Sometimes God gave them a message to speak. Sometimes God said, I want you to act out. Remember Hosea, Mary, and Gomer? He's acting out a message. Ezekiel, really, I feel sorry for Ezekiel sometimes because some of the things that God told Ezekiel to do. Ezekiel one time was told, I think in Ezekiel chapter 4, where God told him to take a clay tile and draw on it Jerusalem and then to lay siege against it. So here's this grown man, takes a clay tile, draws Jerusalem, and then basically has a fake army and he's attacking the tile and everybody's watching him. This is a prophecy. And then God had him lay on his one side, was it 390 days and then 40 days on the left, something like that. He had to lay on one side and then the other side. And he's basically acting out a prophecy. Well, what's going to happen in Zechariah 11 is Zechariah is going to act out a part. And the part that he's going to act out is the part of a shepherd. Verse number 4, thus said the Lord my God. He's saying it to Zechariah, feed the flock of the slaughter. He's going to don a shepherd's garment. He's going to go out. He's going to pretend to be a shepherd and do a shepherd's work. And the role that he's going to play is the role of Christ as the shepherd of Israel. He's not going to just tell them that they're going to reject the Messiah. He's going to act out what they're going to do when Christ comes. Now you're looking very skeptical of that. So look at verse number 4. Verse number 4, thus saith the Lord my God, feed the flock of the slaughter. Zechariah, I want you to go out and I want you to feed a flock of sheep. Gather a flock together, take them out to a pasture, stay with them all day, lead them to water, bring them back to the fold. And so the people watch Zechariah, dress like a shepherd, get a flock of sheep, goes out to a pasture, watches them all day, feeds them, waters them, brings them back to the fold at the end of the day. They are called the flock of the slaughter. Sheep that are marked for the butcher. These are sheep that are marked for slaughter. Get those sheep. Now here's what Zechariah is acting out. That Israel will reject their Messiah. They're going to be marked for the slaughter. But the shepherd is going to feed them one more time, hoping that they will eat, giving them one more chance. God already knows that a terrible judgment is coming against them, but he sends a shepherd to try and feed them. Look at verse number 5. Verse number 5. Whose possessors slay them and hold themselves not guilty, they that sell them say, blessed be the Lord, for I am rich, and their own shepherds pity them not. For I will no more pity the inhabitants of the land, saith the Lord, but, lo, I will deliver the men, every one into his neighbor's hand, and into the hand of his king. They shall smite the land, and out of their hand I will not deliver them, and I will feed the flock of slaughter. Now, here's the way that I read this. Verse number 4, don shepherd's garments, play the role of a shepherd, feed the flock. Verse 5 and 6 are a parenthesis. Verse 7 is back to him feeding the flock, playing the role. So verse number 5 and 6 are a parenthesis. It's going to explain to you, help you to understand what Zechariah is doing. It mentions in verse number 5, whose possessors slay them. I believe that the possessors are foreign oppressors. They are foreign nations. God is going to use a foreign nation, as he has before, to execute his judgment against these people. They are going to come. They're going to slay them. They won't feel guilty about it. They're going to sell them. They're going to get rich off of it. And here's what you have to understand about God, is that God ordains foreign nations to execute his judgment against Israel, and then when they go too far, he then punishes the nations for what they do against Israel. He uses them to do his work of judgment against his people for their sin. But when they are excessive, when they are cruel, when they are vindictive, when they go too far, then God holds them accountable for what they did against his people. Hold your finger right here. Go to Jeremiah chapter 50. If you're still with me, say amen.
Amen.
Jeremiah chapter 50. I'll show this to you. Jeremiah 50. Look in verse number 17. Israel is a scattered sheep. The lions have driven him away. First, the king of Assyria hath devoured him. And last, this Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, hath broken his bones. Now watch this. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will punish the king of Babylon and his land as I have punished the king of Syria. God sent the Assyrians and the Babylonians to punish Israel. They executed God's judgment, but they were cruel, they were excessive, they were severe, they delighted in Israel's punishment, and they even mockingly excused it. Look back in verse number 7, all that found them had devoured them. And their adversaries said, here's what they said, we offend not because they've sinned against the Lord, the habitants of justice, even the Lord, the hope of their fathers. They excused their cruelty by saying, we're doing the Lord's work. They're sinners, so we're justified in what we're doing. And God says, you went too far. And I'm going to punish those nations. Now come back to verse 5, Zechariah 11 to verse 5. Here's what the oppressor is going to do. He's going to slay them and hold themselves not guilty. They won't feel any remorse, any guilt about what they're going to do to the nation of Israel. They're going to sell the people into slavery. They that sell them say, blessed be the Lord, mockingly. They're going to take you, the nation of Israel, they're going to sell you into slavery. Tens of thousands of Jews were sold into slavery in AD 70. So this literally comes true. And they're going to mockingly say, oh, the Lord's blessing us. We're getting rich selling these Jews. And the last part, and their own shepherds pity them not. The shepherds of Israel are the religious leaders. And they're not going to do anything to help the people during that time. Well, what could they have done to help? What they could have done is preached the truth to Israel. They could have told them that we rejected our Messiah. They could have led the nation into repentance and turned to Messiah. That would have been a big help. But they're corrupt and they're getting rich off of the people and they're oppressive themselves and they don't really care what happens to the people. And so they pity them not. And so their foreign oppressors are going to have no pity. The religious leaders are going to have no pity. Verse 6 is really bad. God's not going to have any pity. In verse 6, for I will have no pity. When they turn their back on Christ, God will turn his back on them. He will allow them to suffer. He will allow them to be scattered. And he would not pity them. And there's an interesting phrase here. Look at verse number 6. He says, I would deliver the men, everyone, into his neighbor's hand and into the hand of his king. And I really struggled over that. Because did Israel have a king? They rejected Christ as their king. So did Israel have a king? I would deliver every man into the hand of his king. Look at John chapter 19. John chapter 19. I'm going to tell you, the way this Bible is put together and the way that prophecy is fulfilled, it is almost eerie. Look at John chapter 19. And look at verse number 14. Crucifixion scene, Pilate. It was the preparation of the Passover. And about the sixth hour, he saith unto the Jew, behold your king. Here's your king. Verse 15, they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate saith unto them, shall I crucify your king? And notice what they said. The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. We want him to be our king. We'd rather Caesar be our king than Jesus. And Zechariah said, he shall deliver every man into the hand of his king. And the king that they chose would be the king that would come and destroy their nation. They were delivered into the hand of their king. So verse 5 and 6 is giving you some context. It's telling you why this is going to happen. Now look at verse number 7, all right? Stay with me, verse number 7. I will feed the flock of slaughter. Even you, O poor of the flock. He comes into the acting out of the prophecy. Zechariah says he fed the flock. It was really only the poor of the flock that came to eat. When Christ came, the rich and the mighty and the noble didn't want to have anything to do with him. It was the destitute, the poor, the outcast that came to Jesus. But notice what he does. I took him to be two stages. The one I called beauty and the other I called bands. And I fed the flock. So he takes two staves, and he names one of them beauty and one of them bands. And this is where it begins to get very difficult. Now here's the best that I could come up with, and I read one preacher that has preached on Zechariah, and I read his sermon this afternoon on Zechariah chapter 11, and I don't know how he did it, but he's preaching against Joyce Myers right here. And I agree with everything he said about Joyce Meyer, but I couldn't find her in the verse. It wasn't beauty and it wasn't bands. And I don't know. I couldn't find it. Most commentators say beauty speaks of grace, favor, graciousness. Bands speaks of unity. When you think of these two staves, they are symbolic of the type of ministry that Christ would have. Remember, Zechariah is playing the role of the ministry Christ would have at his first coming. And when he came, he was gracious and he was tender and he was kind and he was loving. And when he came to gather the lost sheep of Israel back into one nation and to be their king. He came to unite all the wayward sheep of Israel back into one fold. So in poetic language, it is saying that the true shepherd of Israel would come with beauty and bands, with grace and unity. In verse number 8, three shepherds also I cut off in one month, and my soul loathed them, and their soul also abhorred him. No, I think this is where he had Joyce Meyer, was right there in verse number 8. My soul loathed, I think that's where he was, somehow he got Joyce Meyer out of verse 8. Three shepherds also I cut off in one month. Probably not three particular men. Not saying that there's three men that I'm going to single out. I think that it's probably talking about the scribes, the Pharisees, the rabbis, who were the false shepherds of Israel. 1 month poetic language. It's not going to take long for the true shepherd, for Christ, for his patience to wear out with them. He would denounce them. And so that's probably what verse number 8 is talking about. He's going to come with grace and unity, and he's going to try to gather the lost sheep of Israel together. The false teachers are going to oppose him, and he would cut them off. So in verse number 9, then said I will not feed you. That that dieth, let it die. That that is be cut off, let it be cut off. And let the rest eat every one the flesh of another. It sounds like that Zechariah turns to the sheep that won't eat and says, then just die. I'm not going to try to feed you. Just be cut off. And by the way, that's exactly what happened. The people rejected Christ and finally he turned away. You see the beginning of that in Matthew chapter 13. When he begins to speak to them in parables and he's hiding further truth from them. They wouldn't eat when he tried to feed them, so he cuts them off. In verse number 10, and I took my staff, even beauty, and cut it asunder, that I may break my covenant which I made with all the people. It was broken in that day. And so the poor of the flock that waited upon me knew that it was the word of the Lord. He took that staff of graciousness and he broke it. He broke it, and he promised that he would protect them, but since they rejected him, he's going to allow them to be destroyed, and I'm not going to be gentle anymore. That staff is broken. And when judgment comes, there is a remnant who knows that it is the doings of the Lord, because it says that the poor of the flock that waited upon me knew that it was the word of the Lord. A remnant of believers would know what is happening. Now, it's predicting judgment. Judgment is coming. Because they reject their Messiah, this great devastation is coming. And Zechariah is acting this out. Now you stop at this point, and here's what you think. That maybe the judgment that God sent to Jerusalem, maybe it was too severe. In AD 70, when the city is completely destroyed, did they really deserve to have 1 million of their kinfolk killed? Did they really deserve to be sold into slavery? For an entire civilization to be scattered to the wind? And so you pause in this judgment and you think, was it too severe? Was God too vindictive? And so Zechariah pauses and says, let me put this in perspective. And so in verse number 12 and 13, there is another parenthesis. And it's going to put this whole why into perspective. Look at verse 12. And I said unto them, if ye think good, give me my price. And if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. Now you recognize that, don't you? That's a prophecy of the betrayal of Christ by Judas Iscariot, betrayed him for 30 pieces of silver. But I want you to see that in its context. Here's what the Lord says. He looks to Israel and he says, what am I worth to you? What price would you place on me? What is my value? If ye think good, give me my price. After the miracles and the healings and the teachings, and I've healed your sick, and I've raised the dead, and I've cast out demons, and I've done all of these things in your midst, what's the price? What value would you place? If none, then forbear. What price would you give for me? And so they thought about it. And they said, 30 pieces of silver. That's the price. And here's the problem. That's a mockery. That's an insult. Because Exodus 21 and verse 32 sets the price of a slave that has been injured by an ox at 30 pieces of silver. So if you own an ox and that ox gores another man's slave and injures that slave, then the compensation for that injured slave is 30 pieces of silver. I have no idea how much money that is in today's economy, but basically what they're saying is your value to us is about the price of an injured slave. That's what it is. That's contempt. That's hatred is what that is. 30 pieces of silver. They were contemptible. They hated him. We think that you are as valuable as an injured slave. So verse number 13. The Lord said unto me, cast it unto the potter, a goodly price that I was prized at of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of the Lord. You know, that prophecy is literally fulfilled. Where Judas betrayed the Lord for 30 pieces of silver. Then he came back and cast it to the priest's field in the temple. And they took the money and literally bought it filled. And it's called the potter's field. So what verse 12 and verse 13 is telling you is, hey, the judgment that's going to come upon them is not too severe. This is the reason why. This is how they treated the true shepherd of Israel. You come to verse number 14, it brings you back to the judgment that he's going to bring against them. Then I cut aside sunder mine other staff, even bands, that I may break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. Whatever unity they had held on to, I'm going to break it and I'm going to scatter them. The tribes had been scattered before, but this time there'll be no national identity. There'll be no tribes together. The bands of the nation would be broken, and they'll go into 2,000 years of dispersion. So here's what the chapter is saying. God's going to appear in the person of Jesus Christ. He will attempt to feed His flock. Only the poor of the flock will follow Him, and the rest, especially the leaders, are going to reject Him. And this good shepherd, this king, will have no more value to them than that of an injured slave. He's going to be mocked at and scoffed, and he's going to be treated contemptibly. And as a consequence, the people are going to be given over to severe judgment. And this judgment is going to encompass death and famine and war and all of that. And it's going to end in the destruction of the nation. And it happened. It happened just as Zechariah predicted. So you have the rejection of Israel's true shepherd. If you notice in verse 15, the Lord said unto me, here's the second scene. And aren't you glad tonight that it's only three verses long? In verse 15 through 17, you have the rise of the false shepherd. Look at verse 15. The Lord said unto me, take unto thee the instruments of a foolish shepherd. For lo, I will raise up a shepherd in the land, which shall not visit those that be cut off, neither shall seek the young one, nor heal that is broken, nor feed that standeth still, but if shall eat the flesh of the fat and tear their claws in pieces. Woe to the idle shepherd that leaveth the flock. The sword should be upon his arm and upon his right eye. His arm should be clean dried up, and his right eye shall be utterly darkened. I believe that Zechariah is going back to acting something out. He's been acting out the role of Christ, the shepherd of Israel. Now, God wants him to play a different role. This time, he's going to play the role of a foolish shepherd. I'm going to let the cat out of the bag early. The foolish shepherd is the Antichrist. He's played the role of Israel's true shepherd. Now, he's going to play the role of Israel's false shepherd. I could preach an entire message on Antichrist. I'll not. I'll give you a synopsis. At the very beginning of the tribulation, there's going to rise up a man who's going to become the leader of the world. He'll be a human being, not a demon, not an angel. He'll be a human being. He will be the most vile, rebellious, wicked man that has probably ever lived. He's called the false shepherd and the idol shepherd of Israel. 1 John 4 and verse 3, every spirit that confesses not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is that spirit of Antichrist, wherever you've heard that it should come. 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, then shall that wicked be revealed. John 5 and verse 43, I am come in my Father's name, and ye receive me not. That happened the first coming. If another shall come in his own name, him ye will receive, and that's exactly what they'll do. During the tribulation, Satan will have one man as his pawn. He will gain control of the entire world for a very short time. His ultimate goal will be to destroy Israel once and for all. He will set up a government that is pure evil. He will lead the armies of the world against Christ when He returns. He'll be an intellectual genius. He'll be an outstanding orator. a master politician, a commercial wizard, a military genius, and a religious leader. In the end, he will set up an idol in the temple and demand to be worshipped as God. By the way, he's a real man. I think, this is just opinion, I think that he is probably living on earth right now. Right now. I don't know, you don't know who he is. I don't know who he is. I don't even know if he knows who he is. I'm not sure. But I believe he's living. I believe he's ready to enter the world stage, waiting for Jesus to rapture us out of here. Do you know how, I'll just give this to you quickly and I'll be done. Well, it won't be done. I'll move on. You know how sometimes people attach numerical values to a name? The way that you do that is you number A through Z, and you number it 1 through 26. So A would have a value of 1, B would be a value of 2, C would be a value of 3, and on and on. Now, you take this for whatever it's worth, all right? I'm not prophesying anything. If you take the name, somebody said, if you take the name Henry Kissinger, and if you add up the numerical value of all the letters in his full name, that you come to 666, Mark of the Beast. Now, I'll tell you what that means. Absolutely nothing. Don't mean a thing. Here's what you need to know about the Antichrist, is that when he comes, he'll deceive Israel. What's going to propel him to the national stage is he's going to solve the Middle East crisis. He's going to have the plan to bring peace to the Middle East. And what begins the tribulation is when he makes a peace treaty with Israel for 7 years. And halfway in, 3.5 years in, he's going to break that. But they're not going to know that yet. And the nation of Israel is going to accept him. He's going to be their Savior. He's going to be their Messiah. And in that way, he's the false shepherd of Israel. Now, you come back to chapter 11, Zechariah chapter 11. And here's what you have to realize. There's a huge gap of time between verse 14 and verse number 15. The first part of the book describes the rejection of the true shepherd, the judgment that's going to follow. Now in verse number 15, the prophecy moves all the way into the tribulation. Look, if you would, in verse number 15. The Lord said unto me, take unto thee yet the instruments of a foolish shepherd. What are the instruments of a foolish shepherd? I don't know. Maybe it's a broken staff. Maybe it's a little stick that acts like a staff. I don't know. But he's to act out as a foolish shepherd. However you do that, they would know that he's acting out not like a real shepherd, but like a foolish shepherd. By the way, the word foolish doesn't mean silly or retarded. The word foolish can mean wicked. If you look at the book of Proverbs, sometimes wickedness and foolishness are used synonymously. And so this foolish shepherd, this wicked shepherd, maybe he's going to have a club to beat the sheep instead of a staff to lead them. I don't know, but he plays the role of a foolish shepherd. But look at verse number 16. For lo, I, God, will raise up a shepherd in the land. Do you know who will be in control when Antichrist comes? It will not be Satan. It'll be God. Antichrist will be a pawn in the hands of Satan. God's going to allow him to raise up, and God's going to use him. I will raise up a shepherd. And the language of verse number 16 is simply telling you he's not going to care for Israel like a true shepherd would. All of the things that Christ did, this shepherd is not going to do any of these things. He's going to feed on the sheep instead of feeding them. He's going to be greedy. He's going to be selfish. He doesn't fix broken bones. He doesn't go out and look for the lost lambs. That's describing exactly how Antichrist is going to treat Israel. And during the tribulation, 2 out of 3 Jews will be killed under Antichrist's reign. And you've got to ask, what kind of question is it? And it's inconceivable that a shepherd would even behave that way. But this is the shepherd that they'll receive. They'll turn their back on their real shepherd. The one that they want is the one that they're going to get. But then in verse number 17, woe to the idle shepherd that leaveth the flock. The sword should be upon his arm and upon his right eye. His arm should be clean dried up and his right eye shall be utterly darkened. The right eye is a symbol of strength. The right arm is a symbol of strength. The eye is a symbol of intelligence, and the sword of God is going to cut him off. He's coming. God will raise him up. He's going to treat them like an idol shepherd, like a false shepherd. He's going to devour them. But then God's going to come, and God's going to judge. Woe. Woe. You don't want to be him. Woe be unto him when Jesus comes the next time. And then you get to chapter 12, and we won't tonight, but you get to chapter 12, they shall look upon him whom they have pierced. They'll recognize him the next time. Now, if you are still awake, you have made it through one of the most difficult chapters in all the Bible. But I believe that the Bible fits like a glove. I'm pretty sure that's the message contained therein. I don't think it has anything to do with Joyce Myers. I really don't. I think that's the message. Aren't you glad that the Lord is my shepherd? Amazing prophecies written 2,500 years before. And he sees two comings in one chapter. Great chapter. Chapter 12 next week. Chapter 12 next week. It'll be a whole lot easier.